Мы, конечно, понимаем.
Of course, we understand that the award today goes to the entire community of investigative journalists. My colleagues have exposed money laundering schemes and ensured that billions of stolen rubles have been returned to the treasury. They've revealed offshore accounts and stopped barbaric logging of Siberian forests.
That's Russian journalist Dmitry Muratov accepting the Nobel Peace Prize last year. He was one of two winners of it. He is the editor of Russia's last independent newspaper, Novaya Gazeta. Since Russia invaded Ukraine last month, most of the country's independent media outlets have shut down and at least 150 journalists have fled the country. That's because the Kremlin now criminalizes the publication of what it calls fake news, with up to 15 years in prison. And that could include anything that challenges the government's official narrative that its war in Ukraine isn't really a war. The Russians call it a special military operation. But Muratov is still in Moscow publishing three papers a week. Now he's auctioning off his Nobel Peace Prize and donating the proceeds to Ukrainian refugees. Joining us now is Paul Soni. He's national security reporter for The Washington Post, and he recently profiled Dmitry Muratov. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Was it difficult to reach him and talk to him?
No, it was not. You know, we had a conversation over the phone, and it was pretty easy to set up.
So he's pretty open, pretty frank about what he's doing, and yet he has to sort of play this double game and publish in the newspaper a version of what his reporters are reporting on that wouldn't necessarily anger the government. Must be a very, very delicate balancing act.
It's definitely a delicate balancing act. And, you know, it's something that to some degree, he's certainly used to balancing his reporters' content with the pressure that Russian authorities have placed on the media for a long time. But we haven't seen anything like what the Russian government has done since this war started. On March 4th, they passed the law on fakes. And basically what it does is it criminalizes any sort of reporting on the Russian armed forces that essentially differs from the government line. It caused Russia's main independent television channel, TV Deutsch, to shut down. It caused a lot of journalists to leave the country because simply sort of explaining what was happening in the war suddenly possibly carried a 15-year prison sentence. But he has kept his newspaper open. And what they have done is they essentially report the stories as they would. And then an editor inside the paper will essentially like line out what they think might run afoul of the law. And then they are sort of transparent with their readers about what has been cut out and what was in the place of what has been cut out. So giving sort of a description of this is where we talked about dead Russian soldiers, or this is where there was commentary from a Ukrainian military official, which they're not allowed to quote. So he's found a way of really getting through what's happening in Ukraine and during the war. They have correspondents in the conflict zone while still kind of abiding by these rules. The question is, you know, it seems like these rules might get even more stringent. Just this week in the Duma, they have sought to sort of expand this censorship law to include not only the Russian armed forces, but different parts of the Russian government, which really might tie the hands of any journalists, remaining journalists trying to operate in Russia. But that sort of remains to be seen.
Well, I guess I'm wondering why Putin doesn't just shut it down entirely. Why does he let it operate in this gray area?
Yeah, it's a really great question. And, you know, we certainly asked him that. And he said, I'm not Putin, so I don't know. He said, you know, ask Putin. I don't think anyone is under any illusions. I think there was a time in Russia where people thought that the Putin government wanted to keep some sort of liberal opposition around in order to allow people to sort of express themselves, but kind of keep it a little bit in a sandbox. I think any illusions about that at this point are pretty gone. You know, Alexei Navalny, the main opposition politician, was poisoned and put in jail. His organization was systematically dismantled and essentially called terrorists. Independent journalists were all labeled foreign agents and driven out of the country by criminal investigations and being followed by Russian intelligence. So I don't think anyone at this point thinks that Putin would sort of think twice about shutting them down, but they are kind of one of the oldest, if not the oldest, opposition newspaper in Russia. Mm-hmm. So in a way, they're kind of the first standing and the last standing.
And how much reach do they have? How many people are they reaching with their reporting of this war and yes. possibly influencing?
So they have, you know, they have a print circulation of about 126,000, and then they get about 30 million users, unique users a month on their website. But then there's a lot of even more traction on social media. So they have a Telegram channel and a Twitter feed, and probably millions more are seeing their headlines or content that way. So they certainly have a significant reach, but Russia's a country of whatever 140, 150 million people. But certainly within Moscow and St. Petersburg and within the intellectual elite, they have a lot of traction.
So what happens if and when Putin shuts it down or it makes it impossible for them to report even the basic news about this war, or if Muratov is arrested?
Yeah, I don't think anyone is in a situation where they could exclude any of those possibilities, just because we've sort of seen Russia just not only in the last 2 to 3 years, but really since the war started, just kind of careen towards a much more authoritarian, totalitarian society, where even just people are being arrested for just holding up, walking outside and holding up posters that don't even say anything on them. That's sort of the level of sensitivity to dissent that mm-hmm. is going on right now in Russia. So I'm sure it's something that they have contemplated, the newspaper itself. What has happened to other Russian independent publications that have been critical of the government? Some of them have gone abroad, sort of operating outside, having their editors outside the country and some of their reporters. But, you obviously lose a lot by that, because fundamentally, it's important to be able to go to events in Russia, speak to people in Russia. At some point, if you're operating from outside Russia, after a while, you sort of start to lose touch with the stories and the people, which is, those are the people they're serving.
Right, exactly. And so I guess what it really means is that people inside Russia are getting only, by and large, the information that the state feeds them. So where are they getting that information from? Are the state-sponsored channels and still up and running and pumping out this propaganda?
So the way that a lot of people are getting information, if they are digitally savvy, is through Telegram, and YouTube is still available in Russia. They blocked Facebook, but YouTube is still available. So I think a lot of people are going online and watching YouTube videos. I think they're in these various Telegram channels, which are providing information. So if you're a digitally savvy person, you certainly can find ways to get information if you want it. I think a lot of Novaya Gazeta's readership, however, is actually older people. Mm-hmm. It's sort of the diehard liberal crowd from Moscow that dates back to the fall of the Soviet Union and people who were dissidents during the Soviet Union. So there's kind of an importance in some ways of them remaining in print, because there are a lot of people over the age of 60 or 70 who are not that digitally savvy and are not really able to figure out how to install a VPN on their computer, on their cell phone, or go on YouTube to watch videos.
Well, Paul, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
That's Paul Soni. He's national security reporter for The Washington Post. Coming up here in Los Angeles, an inspector general identifies sheriff's deputies involved in gang-like groups. We'll talk with him next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. More than 40 LA County Sheriff's deputies are members of gang-like cliques within the department. That's according to the LA County Inspector General Max Huntsman. He said so in a letter he sent to Sheriff Alex Villanueva this week. Huntsman didn't name names, but he says he's compiled this list of deputies from the Sheriff Department's own investigations. He says the deputies belong to two groups operating out of two stations, the Bandidos in East L.A. and the Executioners in Compton. And Inspector General Max Huntsman joins me now. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madeline.
Well, we've been hearing for years about these deputy gangs, but you say you've ID'd 41 sheriff's deputies who are members of these two gangs, but you didn't name them in this letter. Do you know who they are?
Yes. I didn't identify them. The Sheriff's Department identified them. They conducted two internal affairs investigations into these groups and identified 41 people who appear to be members, and we're charged in the Inspector General's office under state law in investigating such evidence, and so we've asked the Sheriff's Department to cooperate, as the sheriff is duty-bound to do so, and instead he has said that I'm corrupt and he won't give me anything.
He won't talk to you? He won't testify? He won't give you documents? That's what you're saying?
All these things have happened. He's been told in court he has to respond to subpoenas. He won't testify. He won't provide documents. We have up on our website, people want to go look at it. We've been giving them letters as long as he's been the sheriff requesting information regarding the fraud in Compton, regarding the cover-up of photos being taken at the Kobe Bryant crash scene, a variety of allegations of corruption in the sheriff's department, and all of them have been stonewalled, including this one.
Well, let me just read a statement he posted on Facebook. He says, once again, we have received unproven allegations alleging deputy gangs by Inspector General Max Gustav Huntsman. We have read the letter from Mr. Huntsman and is consistent with his unhealthy obsession to attack the department. He has failed to provide any actual evidence or new information. How do you respond to that?
Well, it's a political attack with no purpose. The letter we sent him said, you've identified some people. We need to investigate them. Please send us the evidence. I didn't allege anything other than that they have evidence that suggests these groups are gangs under the new California legal definition. It's our duty. We're a law enforcement agency just like they are. We just have a more narrow focus, which is constitutional behavior by the police. And so we are trying to do our duty. And instead of them supporting us, as you would think they would want to do, to provide public confidence in the police, the attacks continue.
What is the definition of gang? Because that very word has been a point of contention with the sheriff. In fact, he issued a cease and desist letter last month to the department, the Board of Supervisors, actually, demanding that they stop calling them gangs, these deputy groups.
Yeah,
why are you calling them gangs, and what's the definition?
I'm not. The California state law calls them gangs. Mm-hmm. It has a definition that's been effective as of January 1st, and under that definition, some gang-like conduct that's been identified, such as the Jump Out Boys who were fired by the Sheriff's Department, the Vikings who were found to be a white supremacist organization by a federal judge years ago, the 2,000 and 3,000 boys who had a big brawl. And now it appears the Bandidos, based on the brawl at East L.A., the Executioners, not a name they use, but ones given to them who have a Nazi helmet tattooed on their thigh. All these groups appear to have engaged in conduct that violates that new California law. And that's what we need to investigate, to find out who their members are, to be fair to the members, to find out what they thought they were joining, what they're involved in, and to make sure that to the extent that it's inconsistent with upholding the Constitution and discharging their legal duties, that we put a stop to it.
So in your letter, you identified two gangs, the Bandidos out of East L.A. and the Executioners out of Compton, out of those two stations. But there are more, right, allegedly?
Yeah, those two are, I don't say they're gangs, they are possibly gangs. The Bandidos engaged in a beatdown of other deputies that is the subject of a report on our website as well, which sure looks gang-like. And over the years, there have been many allegations against them, which have been found to be true, which appear gang-like. So you might well conclude they're a gang, but we have to collect evidence in order to present it to the state for the state to make a determination under the new rules regarding certification or decertification of police officers. So it's not a question of what people have heard of. We heard of lots of stuff over the years, but we have to collect evidence. The Executioners, as I say, they have a Nazi helmet as part of their tattoo. It's hard to believe that such a group would not be perceived as discriminating based on race. And it appears that both those groups are do not contain any significant number, possibly zero African Americans or women, and that's a problem under the California law, under federal law as well.
How is this affecting their interactions with the larger community?
I think it absolutely destroys the credibility of the sheriff's department across the board. For the larger community to see these kinds of groups protected, to see the information about them not provided in discovery as required by the Constitution, even if the sheriff's story about how they're just kind of cute high school hijinks of hazing gone wrong, he likes to call it, they would be destroying the credibility of the department. And we have information that we have to investigate that their conduct has been much worse, including things like withholding backup from deputies who are not in compliance with their idea of how they ought to behave. So it's really destructive. And then, of course, to see a law enforcement agency attacking a public official for trying to determine whether or not there's corruption inside that agency, which is a repeat of what happened under Baca and Tanaka, and the federal government had to get involved. For the public to see that kind of conduct, I think, is incredibly destructive and destructive of public safety in general.
Now, he says he has taken action, that he has fired a couple of sheriff's deputies in the Compton station. He's transferred 13 or so others, and he has prohibited sheriff's deputies from joining groups that commit misconduct, quote unquote.
When a person places five cards in front of you on the table face down and says they're all aces, and you ask them if you can turn one or two of them over and they say no, you shouldn't believe what they tell you.
Okay. So you don't think that he's taking any substantive action?
I think the substantive action, the attacks on me and my staff that violate penal code and civil codes about what he's supposed to be doing to allow us to verify or disprove, those are so destructive that any other transfer he might have done of somebody pales in comparison to the message he's sending to his staff, that it's a green light on the Office of Inspector General and anybody else who looks at them funny. That message is much more destructive than anything else he could be doing behind the scenes. And so the first step is he has to come into compliance with the law regarding oversight. And then we can look at the evidence as to whether or not what he's telling you is true.
So this has been going on for a long, long time. A report from Loyola Law School released last year details 50 years of these quote-unquote deputy gangs, and they identified 18 different groups over the years. Some are still around. So how do you dismantle something that is so seemingly entrenched?
Well, first you need the will, and as you can see, the Sheriff's Department does not have the will, but that's why the state has passed a law to have an external process. The Civilian Oversight Commission is going to conduct a process of looking into it. I'm going to conduct an investigation in which we identify individuals, because it's the secrecy of these groups that has caused half of the damage they've caused. So we're going to identify people. We're going to make sure the Sheriff's Department complies with its constitutional obligations in criminal cases. We're going to make sure that they comply with their constitutional obligations again, as to the public and as to their own deputies. And when we're done with that, we've shown a light upon the gangs. I'm hoping that they will fade away, but I can't tell you in advance whether or not we'll be successful.
All right. Max Huntsman, Inspector General at the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Office. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, we continue our series on the documentaries nominated for an Oscar today, Attica, which looks at the deadliest prison uprising in U.S. history. Inmates had taken over the prison to demand better treatment.
You know, if we have to be in prison, we just want to be able to live here with dignity and these basic human rights that we should expect as human beings.
The Attica filmmakers are here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. 50 years ago, at the maximum security state prison Attica in upstate New York, more than 1,000 inmates overwhelmed dozens of guards and civilian prison workers and took control of the prison.
We started hearing these sirens going off. I said, what the hell is this?
And all of a sudden, I seen the metal shop door open, and I seen guys come running in there with great big pipes and knives.
They killed one guard and took the rest hostage. The prisoners demanded better treatment and living conditions. Days of back and forth negotiations yielded no resolution. So New York's governor, Nelson Rockefeller, ordered state troopers to retake the prison.
We ain't got no guns to shoot back. You know what it is to shoot somebody and they can't shoot back? Lord have mercy.
The violence that followed left 29 inmates dead and 10 of the hostages, all of whom were killed by law enforcement. The documentary Attica looks back at the biggest prison uprising in U.S. history. It's nominated for Best Documentary Feature at this year's Academy Awards. And ahead of Sunday's Oscars ceremony, we're featuring the nominated documentaries. Today, we revisit an interview with the directors of Attica, Stanley Nelson and Tracy Curry. I spoke with them last fall. So your film drops us immediately into the moment the uprising began, but I want to go back to before it happened to figure out what led up to this. And I want to begin by playing a clip of tape with two voices. The first is former Attica prisoner Arthur Harrison, and then the second is an attorney named Joe Heath describing the conditions inside the prison.
A roll of toilet paper would have to last you a month. You have to be a magician or tear up papers out of, you know, the books and stuff like that to wipe your behind and stuff like that. Basic things like toothpaste, a change of sheets more than once a month, clothes being clean, personal hygiene things, being treated like human beings.
There was no religious freedom, particularly for the burgeoning Muslim movement. They were denied the right to worship. They were fed pork because the prison also had a farm where they raised pigs, so that's what you got.
Stanley, tell me more about what it was like inside Attica. This prison was really considered the end of the line, the worst place anyone could be sent to. What were the conditions like leading up to the takeover of the prison?
Yeah, I think one of the things first we have to note is that, you know, Attica was about 250 miles from New York City, so it was in really far upstate in rural America. It was hard to get to, hard for you to have visitors. The guards were especially cruel. The guards were not trained as guards. It was just a job. They came from what was almost an all-white town in Attica. There were no black or brown guards in Attica. And as Arthur Harrison says later, you know, that
fear. They ran the prison with fear, being scared of them. Were their means of running the prison.
And kind of refused to talk to the prisoners at all.
They'd give you this face, don't talk to me. And it was like that, don't talk to me.
They would hit their sticks on the wall once if they wanted you to go, and then twice if they wanted you to stop.
And this is a metal tip stick, and it rings out, and it bop, and you walk. And then when they want you to stop, they say bop, bop.
That was their communication.
That was how the prison was run.
Mm. And Tracy, what about the racial breakdown inside the prison? I mean, we have heard about prisons today being divided along racial lines. Was that the case back then?
Yes, absolutely, Madeline. I mean, you had a group of primarily Black and Puerto Rican, some white prisoners that mostly came from downstate. So New York City, Buffalo and Rochester, but primarily a population of urban folks that, as you hear someone in the film, to the people who lived in Attica Village and that worked there may as well have been aliens. And so I think, you know, that divide certainly was part of the kindling that ultimately led to the rebellion that happened.
Yeah. And you spoke with several of the spouses and children of some of the guards. And it's not like they didn't know that this kindling was getting drier and drier. And they knew that there were really bad tensions inside the prison. Tensions, of course, they were contributing to, but they were also afraid of, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you hear in the film, the prisoners talk about that buildup of tensions, but you also hear the families of the guards and the children say, my dad came home every day talking about how he could feel it. It was palpable.
Yeah. Well, let's play a clip of what you're talking about. Here is Dee Quinn Miller. She's the daughter of the guard, William Quinn, who was killed. And Don Mitzell, he's the son of the guard, Al Mitzell.
Things were getting worse. And so they had a meeting with the administration. And the administration essentially dismissed their concerns and said, everybody back to work. However, we think maybe it's a good idea if you left your personal belongings at home, like wedding rings, wallets, etc. So my father absolutely knew that something was going on.
I having breakfast with him, and he was talking to me, and I knew he was nervous, but he said, something's going to happen. He said, I just don't know what or when.
All right, so Stanley, the when was September 8th, 1971. What was the animating incident, if you will? What was the match that ignited this kindling?
You know, superficially, it was a fight that happened during the day among some inmates, and they were promised that no retaliation would happen by the guards for fighting, but then the guards came and took the inmates out of the cells and took them to the box, as it was called, where, you know, anything could happen, beatings, whatever. But really, you know, it was, as Tracy said, there were tensions mounting all the time.
Okay, so they managed to get the keys from a guard and unlock the cells and let some of the inmates out. And out of a population of, what, more than 2,000 inmates, half decide to gather into the central part of the prison. Tracy, can you describe where they gathered, this place that they called Times Square?
So the way that Times Square plays into it is that Attica had what was at the time that it was built, a very unique kind of layout. I think it was like the early of 20th century. There had actually been a lot of prison uprisings and I think some escapes. And so the idea was to design a prison that was meant to be escape proof and riot proof. And the way they did that was that, as you can see in the aerial shots of the prison, is they essentially took the old model, which was sort of one big yard in the center of the prison, and they divided it into this grid of four smaller yards, A yard, B yard, C yard, and D yard. With Times Square being at the intersection of those. And there was a series of sort of gates that would allow people to kind of pass through that was controlled by one guard that had keys there. So originally, when the rebellion first happened, the prisoners had managed to take over several parts of the prison. And so there was some initial resistance from guards and law enforcement that essentially sort of forced the prisoners back into this one corner of the prison, and that was DR'd. And so that's how they all sort of ended up there. There just came to be this understanding in the midst of the rebellion, as they all kind of were coalescing around one place, that DR'd was kind of the place to be.
Okay, so this is the Thursday of this period, the first day. And then how do they establish order, like who was in charge and how they were going to organize themselves?
Well, as you see in the film, there was absolute chaos. Originally, I think, you know, one of the people compares it to sort of the Wild Wild West, and, you know, every man is an island unto himself. But I think very quickly, there were some prisoners that realized that they had a very unique opportunity to kind of push for some of the changes that they had been wanting to see. And incidentally, had actually appealed in a petition to the prison prior to this to happen, and nothing happened. And like Stanley mentioned earlier, there were a lot of folks at Attica who had been a part of political movements outside the prison or otherwise became radicalized inside the prison, people who were religious leaders. And so some of those folks kind of took it upon themselves to say, you know, let's get organized. You had people that recognized that maybe we're going to be out here for a few days. So as you see in the film, there were folks in Vietnam who understood sort of how to, you know, establish some sort of livable conditions with the trenches and the tents. And so what is very remarkable is that they were able to, in a short time after the initial chaos, come up with this sort of city within the prison with its own, you know, democratic institutions. And so they voted and they made sure to have representation amongst the leadership from the different racial groups, the different political groups, the different religious groups. And so I think that's one of the most sort of remarkable things about this story, is how quickly the prisoners were able to sort of find some order out of the original chaos.
Right. And so then they also had the guards as hostages, and they didn't attack the guards or beat them up, with the exception of the one guard who did die, William Quinn. And another interesting part was they basically, some of them did want to exact revenge on these guards, but the Muslim prisoners were the ones who guarded them because they didn't believe in violence.
Our understanding of Islam was that you don't harm a captive. Therefore, it was decided to allow the Muslim brothers to look out for them.
I was so mad at them for not letting us get to the police.
because I want to put my hands. I want to get one or two of them and really f*** them up. These are the same police that was talking down to me. So I said, yeah, now what do you think about me now? Yeah, yeah. And the good thing that them Muslims was there, because a lot of them police would have been hurt, really hurt.
Yeah, just to clarify a little bit, there were some guards that sort of experienced some, you know, some injuries initially. But again, once they kind of got into the yard and realized the opportunity they had with the hostages, just strategically, it just did not make sense to harm these people if this is your leverage to kind of exact some of the changes that you're trying to get. And it kind of naturally fell to the Muslims, which, you know, as part of their religious beliefs was you do not harm a defenseless person, you do not harm a hostage. And so, you know, they took great care to make sure that none of the hostages were harmed, made sure that they were fed, made sure that they had mattresses to sleep on. So it was, I think, a point of pride for them that they were not going to, you know, do the same harm to these hostages that they say had been done to them as prisoners inside the facility.
Right. Interesting, because we heard earlier about how poorly the Muslim inmates had been treated with regards to, for instance, their food. They were served a lot of pork.
Yeah, the prisoners were fed on 21 cents a meal, 63 cents a day. I think also, you know, we should note that the guard who died was injured severely at the taking of the prison on the first day, but he did not pass away until the third day. And that really was a change in the whole attitude, makeup, result of what happened in the prison.
Well, let's get to that in a moment, but I want you to set up the scene inside. And I'm also wondering, Stanley, how you got the footage, because there was some remarkable footage of that early day, the first day, the second day, of them setting up the camp, setting up the latrines and the little tents that they slept in, and just the general sense of jubilation that the prisoners were experiencing on that first day.
Yeah, I mean, one of the most remarkable things about Attica and one of the real turning points was that the inmates realized early on that they wanted the media to come in. They thought that the media would give them a certain amount of protection. So early on, cameras came in and filmed a lot of what was going on. And it's just, you know, incredible footage, you know, not only of them setting up tents and food and digging the latrines, but also as the days progressed of the negotiations and the inmates making speeches.
Well, we have a clip of one of those inmates on tape at the time. And as you say, the prisoners realized that they now had a voice to the world through the news media. And here he is talking about a few of their demands.
We want to be treated as human beings. We will be treated as human beings. We have come to the conclusion, after close study, after much suffering, after much consideration, that if we cannot live as people, then we will at least try to die like men. If you people do not understand, if you people do not stick with us, we are dead. I appeal, beseech you all to stand with us. Die with us if necessary.
I hear you.
You are all the people. Power to you and all the people.
And Tracy, what did they want? What were they demanding?
Yeah, so there was some back and forth over the course of the negotiations as they kind of coalesced around one final list. But ultimately, the things that they were asking for were sort of basic human rights issues, religious freedom, you know, the basic things like the toilet paper and the shower. They were asking for some sort of systemic things like changes in the parole system. They were asking for an end to some of the violence and the brutality that they were experiencing in the prison. I mean, if you look at the list, it was, you know, the kinds of things that you and I take for granted every day. And I think it's important to know that, because the way that it got covered at the time spent a lot of time on the sort of more sensational aspects of what they were asking for, like, you know, this plane out of the prison, which we kind of talk about in the film. But I think we make it clear that this was sort of a pie in the sky kind of, you know, if we've gotten all these other things and we've gotten the media and these powerful people coming in, why not? But ultimately, that really wasn't the heart and the essence of what it is they were asking for. It really was just to, you know, if we have to be in prison, we just want to be able to live here with dignity and these basic human rights that we should expect as human beings in this system.
So it looked tentatively positive for them until, as you mentioned, one of the officers, corrections officers, died of his wounds that he suffered a few days before, William Quinn. And then everything changed. So what was the reaction on the outside on the part of the head of the prison and on the part of law enforcement and the governor when they found out that William Quinn died?
Well, I think that, you know, as far as law enforcement and the people that had gathered outside, there had already been building tensions because unfortunately there were a lot of rumors flying around, some of which got reported in the media, that the hostages were being tortured, that people were being castrated, that someone had been pushed off a balcony. So you already have these simmering and growing tensions. And so you introduce into that now that, you know, one of the guards, their brother in arms for the people in the village, you know, a member of their community has been killed. And all of a sudden that sort of simmering tension builds up into a rage. And I think on the part of the state, it then just becomes untenable that we continue negotiating with these prisoners and certainly not to offer them the amnesty, which ultimately became sort of the defining issue as far as the prisoners were concerned after William Quinn died.
Right. It means one thing to offer amnesty for the general taking of the prison, but another thing entirely when there's a death of someone involved.
Yeah.
So they decide to go in, and this is on Monday, so 5 days later. And I'm just going to play a clip here of former inmates you talked to in your movie describing what happened.
That gas knocked me down. I don't know what that was. And it had me so weak I could not move.
Put your hands on top of your head and surrender to an officer. I repeat, you will not be harmed. Put your hands on top of your head.
And they got on the microphone. Everybody in D Block Yard, put your hands in the air, and you will not be harmed.
Go to the nearest state police officer, and you will not be harmed.
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 But that was bullshit.
Wow. So then there's a hail of gunfire. And Tracy, is it just chaos, just bullets flying everywhere?
Yeah. I mean, I think what we really tried to do in that scene is give you a sense of what the people in that yard experienced, this orgy of violence and brutality and what it is to kind of be in the middle of that as it happens. I mean, I think you kind of see and understand from the film just how harrowing and traumatic and brutal that whole moment was for everybody that was there.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that we have to understand is first they sent down all this gas, you know, which knocked people down, but you couldn't see, you know, so there was smoke everywhere, so they couldn't even see. They just were shooting randomly, you know, down. And I mean, and it's unbelievable the amount of shooting, and you know, it lasts for like 7, 8, 9 minutes of just, you know, just shooting, you know, into the fog, into the smoke. Anybody down there would get shot. There was no plan. There was just a need to show, you know, force, brute force, and to establish what they call law and order.
And the state never apologized to the relatives, the survivors of either the guards or of the prisoners, right?
No, never. No. And in fact, what you see in the sort of afterword of the film is that, you know, the prisoners, after this decades long legal fight, ultimately get a settlement. The families of the guards did not have that option because in agreeing to sign the workmen's comp checks of their dead husbands and fathers and whatnot, the widows of the guards who were killed forfeited their right to sue the state for damages. And so essentially what happened was after the prisoners received their settlement, the families organized and basically did a public campaign to shame the state of New York into giving them that settlement. And there were a few things that they asked for, one of which was an official apology from the state, which never came to this day.
So what is Attica like now? Have there been prison reforms in the wake of all this?
So immediately after the rebellion in 1971, there were some small changes at Attica prison. You know, I think some of the dividers that kept people separated from their visitors came down. Maybe the food got a little better. There were, you know, things here and there. So I think there are certain things that you probably could point to and say, this is better than that. There's some educational programs. There's this, there's that. But when we kind of talk about, you know, the story and the consequences writ large, I think it's hard to kind of point to anything and say that there has been any really substantive improvement in the carceral system.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today. And thank you for your really important, riveting documentary.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Stanley Nelson and Tracy Curry. Their documentary, Attica, is nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature. And you can hear the original extended version of my interview with them. And that includes how the prisoners were treated at Attica by the prison guards after the uprising. Just go to kcrw.com and search Attica. Coming up, an artist tries to heal our fractured country with clay. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. LA-based ceramicist Adam Silverman is known for pottery and sculptures that really push the boundaries of design and technique. He uses risky firing methods. He creates big, lumpy pots with crackly, textured glazes. His work is in LACMA's permanent collection. For his latest project, Adam Silverman collected raw material from all 50 states, plus D.C. and the five U.S. territories of Puerto Rico, the U.S. Virgin Islands, Guam, American Samoa, and the Northern Mariana Islands. And he used all the earth from these places to make a single material, which he then used to make pottery. The idea is to explore how an intensely divided America can rediscover its commonalities. The project is called Common Ground, and here to tell us more about it is Adam Silverman. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, talk about how you came up with this idea. I understand it began during the Trump administration, when the division was quite high. Well, it's still quite high. So how did you come up with this idea of collecting material from all across America?
Well, it's sort of an extension of a bunch of work I've been doing for the last 15 or so years. The older, earlier work is more about a single location and trying to make work that somehow is inspired by or celebrates the qualities of the place, both biologically in terms of the materials and culturally, and oftentimes how they come together. You know, if you think about looking at America from space, you know, or as an image from a satellite, and all you see is green, blue, and brown. So the materials that I collected were actually clay, wood ash, and water.
And what is wood ash?
Wood ash is any tree or, you know, so people sent it to me from their fireplace or from a barbecue or a pizza oven or a campfire or forest fires. You know, like I have some from various fires around California, wildfires.
So is that how you gathered the material? You asked for people in the various places to send things to you?
Yeah, it started. I mean, I got stuff from California, Texas, and Rhode Island. And then I just started doing the, you know, who do I know who lives in different places, who has family there? And it became like friends of friends. And after I exhausted the kind of 6 degrees of separation thing, I started posting pictures of the map on Instagram saying, and sort of talking about the project and introducing and saying, I need materials from these places. And people started contacting me. So it wound up being mostly people that I didn't know before. And it became a really nice kind of version of what I hope the final project is in terms of creating a community around the project. You know, people would email me or message me on Instagram and I would Google them. And it was always super interesting to see who they were and what they did in their lives. And some of them were clay people and a lot of them were just, you know, outdoors people, or they fished, or they somehow knew how to find clay in the ground.
Well, so I guess that's an interesting sidebar, or maybe that was your intent, I don't know, that you actually created these connections between people in the process of it.
Right. It really wasn't the intent, honestly. I mean, it was much harder to get the materials than I envisioned it being. The whole project has been much harder and more complicated. But it's also been equally rewarding by the same token. So, yeah, the community that was created has been great. And it continues to, you know, now as as the project is starting to go out into the world, it's just becoming this exponentially growing community around it, which is really great. And that is what I had hoped for.
So once you got all this material, did you find that it was significantly different or more in common?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it is like I kept a little archive. I have a spice jar of every clay and every wood ash and every water, and they're lined up and they look totally different, you know, in terms of color. They go from white to green to red to black to gray. But once I started processing the materials and mixing them, obviously it became just one single kind of light brown material, you know, and then the question is like mixing it with different ratios of ash and clay and different temperatures and different kilns. And then there becomes a big variety of different ways that it looks and behaves. Even though it became a single material, it can still look very differently and behave very differently depending on how hot you fire it and what you do with it.
How different is it from the material you usually work with?
Very different. And also it was, you know, there was just no way for me to know what it would look like or do. It was really a very long, slow gamble, because once I mixed everything, it could have technically been disappointing and it could have aesthetically been disappointing. And it turned out to be neither. It turned out to be everything I could have hoped for in terms of, you know, the metaphor of like the beauty and strength and diversity and inclusion. And the material is completely inclusive, totally inclusive, and totally diverse and totally beautiful.
And once you got it, and then what did you do with it? How did you decide to form it?
So that's the second, you know, the first big decision was, do I mix all the materials together and treat it as one, or do I make, you know, 56 things that celebrate 56 individual places and whatever characteristics they may have that we want to celebrate? And so obviously I opted for the former in terms of mixing them all together. And then the second decision was, okay, now what am I going to do with the materials now that I have them and that I can see that it's going to work to make something? So, I mean, I had several ideas. I had two ideas that sort of made it to the finalists, and I decided to just do both. And the first one is a very basic tableware set, a plate, a cup, and a bowl. And the idea was to use them to host meals around the country. And I made 56 of each. So it's basically a big, simple dinnerware set for 56 people to share a meal. And, you know, the idea is a sort of tried and true one of bringing people together around food and using it as a lubricant to start a conversation, like, you know, you might at Thanksgiving with family members who don't always get along, or at a, you know, a state dinner or a negotiation dinner. It's the idea is just that we'll have 56 people around the table who wouldn't ordinarily be around the table together.
And the 56 people represent the 50 states plus DC, yeah, plus the territories.
Right.
And how
right.
do you choose the 56 people?
So, like, I'll just use LA as an example, because this is the first place that we're trying to do it since we're here. I'm here. And I have teamed up on the meal side of the project with a guy from New York, Scott Alves Barton, who's a Foodways scholar, teaches at NYU, and activist, and he's curating the meals. So in LA, for example, we decided that homelessness is the sort of biggest issue that we are living with here. I mean, there are many issues, but I think most people would agree that homelessness is really of paramount importance to think about and talk about and address. So if we say in LA we're going to do a meal or some meals around homelessness, the first thing we did is we found a homelessness activist person to spearhead the programming side of the meal. Scott will spearhead the food side and figure out who's going to make food in LA and why. And then we teamed up with a guy here, Mike Alvadirez, who's a 40-year activist and used to run Skid Row Housing Trust downtown. So he is putting together who would be at the table and why. You might have a group of people from that world exactly. You might have, you know, somebody from the SBA or business interests, homeowners, law enforcement, social workers, of course, homeless people, formerly homeless people, without question. So that's just an example. And again, my role in it is to sort of step back from it. And what I would like to hope is that I'm almost done with my part of the project in terms of making it, and putting it in the world. And then now it'll have this life with other people using it to have the meals around the country.
So you also have ceremonial pots that mm-hmm. are the other side of this. So you have the, right. the plate, the cup, and the bowl, and also these ceremonial pots. What are those for?
So you're right. So that's where I said there were two things and I couldn't decide which one to do. So I decided to just do both. So the pots, although not necessarily around food, the idea is to bring people together to use the pots in some sort of ceremonial, artistic, ritualistic, whatever the word is, depending on who the collaborators are. Similar to the dinnerware stuff, I just want to kind of put it out in the world and hope that there are interesting people wanting to do interesting things with them, and I can sort of fade to the background.
Adam Silverman is an artist based here in Los Angeles. His Common Ground ceremonial pots are now on display at the Japanese American Cultural and Community Center in Little Tokyo. They'll be up there until April 10th. And the first meal is this Sunday, March 27th. There will be more this summer and in the fall in Los Angeles before they move east to DC and New York. And you can learn more about the project at commongroundus.net. Adam, thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
All right, before we go, we will be interviewing the top candidates in the race to be LA's next mayor. What do you want us to ask them? You can tweet us your questions at KCRW Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you tomorrow.